meaning. When my colleagues and I interviewed Principal Greg Green and his staff in 2016, they still faced the same challenges of dealing with a disadvantaged student population that they had before flipping Clintondale High School. But whereas before their work enervated them, now it energized and inspired them, not least because it allowed them to devote more of their time to teaching students rather than disciplining them and breaking up fights. For hours when we visited, Green and his staff talked with us about the flipped model, what new technologies they were excited to try, and most of all, how the flipped model was impacting the students. They felt deep passion and purpose. They were still working hard, but they were accomplishing more and feeling less burned out. I was surprised that one of our seven practices, fight and unite, increased the chance of burning out. Upon reflection, I came up with a possible explanation. Vigorous debates during meetings may produce better decisions, but they can also wear you down. All that frowning and head shaking, all those moderately raised voices, all those attacks and counterattacks. Research has shown that a good intellectual fight, what scientists call cognitive conflict, often accompanies interpersonal friction or emotional conflict. In a study of 612 employees working in industries like manufacturing, telecommunications, pharmaceutical, and governmental defense, an increase in cognitive conflict, for example, how often did the members of your team debate different ideas, predicted higher levels of emotional conflict, as measured by interpersonal clashes, anger, tension, and intra-team rivalry. Friction between colleagues can, in turn, lead to burnout. How do you enhance your job satisfaction? As for job satisfaction, our last well-being factor, four out of our seven practices enhance this benefit, two of them strongly. Passion and purpose loom large. People who are deeply passionate and feel a strong sense of purpose feel far more satisfied in their jobs than those who aren't. One study of 271 working men and women in the United States showed that those who felt very passionate about their jobs were much more satisfied with them. Another study of 260 university employees demonstrated that those who felt that their work contributed to the greater good, I know my work makes a positive difference in the world, also reported much higher job satisfaction than those who didn't. In our study, people who redesigned their job tasks also felt much more satisfied, perhaps because they got a chance to work on more valuable activities, or because they appreciated the autonomy or discretion they had to reimagine their role. Overall, our analysis demonstrates that different smart work practices affect well-being differently. It's not the case that one or two of the seven practices produce well-being, nor are all the effects positive. As a result, simply mastering all seven practices won't yield the greatest performance and well-being gains. You do need to master them, but you also need to adopt three additional tactics to mitigate the negative impacts that some of the practices have on well-being. Spend your time dividend. First, consider how you manage your time. A number of the seven practices free up time in your schedule. By pursuing your collaborative activity in a more disciplined way, you avoid needless collaborations and thus save time. By doing less and obsessing, you focus your efforts on a few key tasks and thus save time. By fighting and uniting, you forego follow-up meetings and thus save time. Your productive debates result in well-considered decisions during the initial meeting. By consistently incorporating feedback into your skills practice, you learn skills with fewer repetitions and thus save time. By redesigning work, you work more effectively to achieve the same or better results and thus, yet again, you save time. All of this time saving piles up. Review your schedule over the past 2 weeks and remove all the assignments, phone calls, email tasks, and meetings you wouldn't have had to bother with if you had followed these practices. Chances are that's a lot of time. I think of this newfound time as a time dividend you generate by practicing the seven practices. The question is, what to do with this dividend? You have two choices. You can reinvest that extra time in work, or you can spend it on outside personal and family time. Think about a company that earns a profit. It can invest that money back into the business, or it can distribute some of it as a cash dividend to shareholders. You are in an analogous situation. You may need to reinvest some of that time back into your work. The do less than obsess practice requires you to spend time obsessing in your few chosen focus areas. Some people put all their time dividend back into their jobs, enjoying little in the way of work-life balance. The great sushi chef Jiro Ono from Chapter 2 lives for work and doesn't like public holidays because they keep him away from his restaurant. But other people we've met do split their time dividends, reserving some extra time for their personal life. Susan Bishop realized a substantial time dividend upon applying do less than obsess. By setting rules regarding which clients to accept and which to reject, she was able to work only in industries where she possessed expertise. As a result, she and her team saved time that they otherwise would have spent learning about new industries. She could have poured all of her time dividend into her remaining client work. Instead, she channeled a portion of that time back into her personal life, being there for her daughter and going back to school. In our large data set of 5,000 managers and employees, most people who were great at work split their time dividends as well. As we've seen, top performers who excelled at do less than obsess didn't work longer hours. They were more effective when they did work. In general, as we saw in Chapter 3, working beyond 50 to 55 hours a week didn't yield significantly higher performance. The traditional work harder mentality runs deep. We think we have to attend that extra meeting, agree to that extra collaboration, or put that extra hour into tweaking that presentation. Don't fall into that trap. You need to break your work harder pattern, setting some clear limits. Obsessing so as to excel in what you do means working up to 50 to 55 hours per week, infusing your work with passion and purpose during those hours, and then taking a break. Spend any hours beyond that, your time dividend, on your personal commitments. Keep your passion in check. As we saw earlier, the practice of infusing work with passion and purpose increases job satisfaction and reduces feelings of burnout, but it also worsens work-life balance. To avoid this trap, keep your passion in check. Even if you're working a reasonable number of hours, don't let your passion for work seep into your leisure time. If you're thinking about work while you're having dinner with friends or watching your kid's baseball game, you're too passionate about work. If you have trouble falling asleep at night because you're thinking about work, or you find yourself checking your email in the bathroom at 3 a.m., you're too passionate about your job. Top performers in our study pursued passions for sure, but they also kept those passions in perspective. Hartmut Goeritz, who spent years redesigning operations at Maersk's Tangier Shipping Terminal, Chapter 3, devoted his off hours to his three kids and to hobbies such as squash and scuba diving. When I asked whether he could forget about his work during leisure hours, he said, "Absolutely. My brain switches over to family mode. I'm very good about that." He noted that he takes time to drop his son off at school each morning, leaves work at around 5 p.m., and works only occasional weekends. When I asked him if he would ever work 70 to 80 hours a week, he told me that he would refuse to do that. "That would kill me, and it would kill my work-life balance." You, too, can be extremely, wonderfully passionate about work and not let it consume you. Don't take it personally, and don't fight nasty. People who reap the full well-being benefits of the seven practices contain the emotional turmoil that work can create. Emotional conflict at work wears people down. One study of 52 staff in a small private hospital in Northern California found that nurses who experienced more unpleasant interactions with colleagues and supervisors were more emotionally exhausted from work and suffered from much higher burnout levels. For introverts and those who tend to avoid conflict, heated debates might prove especially taxing. Don't shy away from mental fights in meetings, but be sure to fight in the right way. As we discussed in Chapter 7, don't make your fighting in team meetings personal, and don't take the comments cast in your direction personally either. Avoid inflammatory language. That's a stupid idea, because such toxic language upsets people. Likewise, when other people make disputes personal in a meeting, try to reorient them. One great tactic is to get more objective, highlighting impersonal data, facts, and numbers as opposed to emotion-laden opinions. Another is to play devil's advocate, a tactic that reduces interpersonal conflict by allowing you to play a role rather than speaking for yourself. For the sake of argument, I am going to disagree. Make fights about ideas, not people. The quality of your debates will improve, the emotional conflict will subside, and your sense of well-being will be better. Work smarter, not harder. With the 7 practices and these 3 additional tactics in place, I have now presented in full our scientifically validated path to greater work performance and well-being. Most of us think we need a strong work ethic and pure grit to achieve greatness. If someone has emerged as a superstar, we assume that he or she works harder than everyone else. Yet the idea that working harder, longer hours, beyond some threshold will yield superior performance is flawed. The best performers don't work harder, they work smarter. They maximize the value of their work by choosing a few priorities and applying targeted, intense effort to excel. I began this book by observing that work smart is a cliche and that no one wants to work dumb. Yet, as we've seen, employees and managers have lacked a clear framework for how to work smart. They haven't parsed out what this phrase really means, nor have they had at their disposal concrete guidelines for what to do on a daily basis. The preceding chapters have provided a framework for working smart. I've focused on individual performance, but the project of improving how we work extends beyond that. As you proceed in your career and take on leadership positions, look around you. Does your organization support working smarter? Many do not. Why do many medical interns work 24 hours straight when that's not the best way of adding value? Why do some McKinsey consultants work 70 to 80 hours a week instead of 50? Almost everything about our organizations supports the work harder mentality, from compensation to the structuring of work processes to the way hiring decisions and promotions are made. Leaders sustain the work crazy hard mentality, expecting more effort from their employees and failing to applaud employees for setting boundaries and performing smart work. The sad part, of course, is that this imperative to work harder reduces the collective performance of a company's employees, which in turn most likely lowers financial results. Some leaders do get it. Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, reputed to be the youngest self-made billionaire in history, has reflected on his time at Facebook and lamented the excessive time he put in. "I wish I had slept more hours and exercised regularly," he wrote in a 2015 blog posting. "I wish I had made better decisions about what to eat or drink. At times, I consumed more soda and energy drinks than water. I wish I had made more time for other experiences that helped me grow incredibly quickly once I gave them a chance." You might think, well, easy for him to say. His breakneck pace helped make Facebook what it is today. That's not Moskovitz's conclusion. As he said, "I believe I would have been more effective if I had prioritized other parts of life, a better leader, and a more focused employee." He goes on to explain, "I would have picked fewer petty fights with my peers in the organization because I would have been generally more centered and self-reflective. I would have been less frustrated and resentful when things went wrong and required me to put in even more hours to deal with a local crisis. In short, I would have had more energy and spent it in smarter ways, and I would have been happier. Let's learn from Moskowitz's experience. And let's learn from our study of 5,000 people drawn from many industries and all kinds of jobs, senior and junior. We can all become great at work and in life by working smarter, not harder. Focus on just 7 core practices and 3 tactics to improve well-being. Understand them. Apply yourself to these 7. Master them. Your performance will likely improve, and you'll feel less stressed and more fulfilled. One day, you might even notice something strange and wonderful happening. You know that colleague who outperforms everyone else, yet who mysteriously leaves the office at a decent hour at the end of every day? The Natalie that I mentioned in Chapter 1 and whom I encountered while working at the Boston Consulting Group in London? That could be you. Epilogue. Small changes, big results. When I was a junior in high school, I was an accomplished track and field runner in my hometown of Oslo, Norway, where I had won 4 regional championships. One competition, the Norwegian National Junior Championship, stands out in my mind. The event started well with a bronze medal in the 4x400 meter. The following day, I anchored the 4x1500 meter race. For much of the race, everything went well. I had positioned myself in the front group as the bell rang for the final lap in the race. With 300 meters to go, I accelerated to the front. Then, another runner overtook me. No problem, I thought. I usually did well in the final sprints. I figured that I could position myself behind him and wait. With 50 yards left, I'd make my move and win. As we went into the finish, I accelerated to pass him. But I miscalculated, advancing too late. As I tried to overtake him, I met a huge headwind. My legs fatigued from earlier races. I didn't have enough strength left. I threw myself at the finish line. The photo finish showed that I lost by 2/100ths of a second. It sure felt more like losing the gold than winning the silver. Looking back on it all these years later, I am struck by how a tiny miscalculation led to such a different outcome. I lost the championship because I made my move a fraction too late. That's often how it works in sports. Just a bit too much topspin on a basketball free shot, or a football wide receiver who breaks a split second too late. These miscues make all the difference. But is that also true at work? As the data and stories in this book demonstrate, small changes in behaviors can have a disproportionate effect on outcomes. In Chapter 3, I used the Archimedes lever to make that point, invoking the phrase, "Give me a lever and a place to stand, I can move the earth." Dr. Michael Benick, the senior doctor described in that chapter, did move the earth, so to speak. Wanting to help hospital patients sleep better at night, he didn't launch some large-scale bureaucratic transformation to make the hospital quieter. Rather, he told the attending nurses and physicians that they should wake him first if they wanted to wake a patient during the night to take a blood sample. No one did. That small alteration changed hospital care and led to a dramatic improvement in the patient's quiet at night score from the 16th to the 47th percentile. A minute lever with a big outcome. That insight, that tiny changes can yield big results, has vast implications for how we choose to work. We don't have to make massive changes in our work to lift our performance. Small changes can be just as effective. That's a hopeful message. Start with small steps. That's working smart, not hard. To close out this book, I highlight a few of those smaller changes from each chapter that can be just right for you as you embark on your journey of becoming great at work. In Chapter 2, Do Less Than Obsess, we saw that the best performers chose a few key areas to work on and then obsessed to excel in those. They went narrow and deep, not broad and shallow. Of course, sometimes you must cut out substantial areas of work, a big project, a large customer, or even a job to get to that level of intense focus. But just as often, small changes, one by one, can free up enough time to do less and obsess. Start by learning to say no to new requests for your time. Give yourself a buffer. The next time someone asks you for something, respond with, "Let me think about it and I will get back to you tomorrow." In the meantime, ask your spouse or a colleague to play the role of naysayer for you. Why might committing to the request be a bad idea? What do you have to lose by taking on the additional work? You can also do what Susan Bishop, the small business manager of the executive search firm, did. She set clear rules ahead of time for which clients to accept, only in media, and a minimum fee of $50,000, and which to reject. You can set such a rule, such as, only attend meetings where I must be present. Still another small change you can make is to apply Occam's razor and start chopping away work you don't have to do. Do you really have to answer those emails, create those extra PowerPoint slides, schedule pre-meetings to prepare for a meeting, or return that phone call? Everything takes time. So chopping off even small tasks can free you up to zoom in and obsess over the few key areas that matter. That brings up the question of what exactly you should focus on and obsess over. Not all work is created equal. Some tasks produce far more impact than others, as we discussed in the Redesign Work chapter. The answer we found in our research is to redesign your work so that you add more activities that create value and stop or reject work that doesn't. Value creation differs from goals. Remember the Hewlett-Packard manager who submitted the quarterly report on time, achieving his goal, but no one read his report. Zero value creation. In contrast, Principal Greg Green of Clintondale High School in Detroit flipped the entire method of teaching, doing homework at school and lecturing via video at home, and thereby transformed student learning and created tremendous value. Now you might say, that's not a tiny change, that's a huge one. True, but Green started with tiny changes. First, he performed a small experiment with one class, then a few more, and so on, until he was confident that he had the new model right. You too can start small, keeping an eye out for tiny but meaningful redesigns. Try to find just one way to reduce the time you spend on activities of little value, like furnishing those reports that no one reads, and to increase an activity that will yield value, returning those customer calls more quickly. Start by looking at your calendar the past 2 weeks. Circle each item that you think created very good value and cross out those that yielded little or no value. Now do the same for the next 2 weeks. Confront yourself. Have the courage to get rid of some of those crossed out upcoming items. Once you focus on activities that have an impact, improve them bit by bit by applying the learning loop as we discussed in Chapter 4. You'll recall from the story of hospital food supervisor Brittany Gavin that a learning loop is about making small changes to achieve a big impact over time. Tweak a way of doing your job, measure the outcome, get feedback on it, modify the approach, and so on, in an upward cycle of improvement. When you're just getting started, keep the risk low. If you're a salesperson tweaking your pitch, modify the pitch with a not-so-important customer. Then observe the impact and tweak it some more. Over time, you might just see a huge uptake in your sales performance. Pursuing this kind of intense, sustained effort requires a high degree of commitment. So how can you turn up your motivation? As we saw in Chapter 5, P squared, top performers became energized by tapping into their passion and a strong sense of purpose. We witnessed how hotel concierge Genevieve Gay matched her passion, "I love interacting with people," with her sense of purpose, helping and caring for hotel guests. As a result, she poured energy into every hour she worked and thereby performed exceptionally well. Unfortunately, the convention is that you need to make a huge change in your life to achieve what Genevieve accomplished. You must quit your job and find a new career that gives you both passion and purpose at work. But as this chapter showed, that's not true. You can make small changes to expand your passions at work. Join a new project that taps into creative passions. Seek out competitive job situations like sales pitches to tap into a passion you might have for competition and winning. Join a training workshop to fuel your passion for personal growth. Have lunch more often with colleagues who make you excited about work. To gain more purpose, look for small ways to add value for your team or organization. Find assignments that are meaningful to you. Spend a few minutes this week reflecting on the ways you're already contributing, perhaps without realizing it. Become more active in social causes your organization might support. Step by step, you're increasing your sense of passion and purpose at work. As we turn to the second half of the book, which focuses on how we can master working with others, here too we can make small changes in how we work. Our top performers were forceful champions, Chapter 6. They inspired people by evoking their emotions. They didn't rely on charisma, but rather on clever tactics. Celebrity chef Jamie Oliver used a giant jiggling mountain of fat to convince parents to improve their kids' diets. Agilent executive Jacob Thason excited an audience of managers by playing a heartfelt video of a young cancer patient who had survived thanks in part to the company's products. Look for creative ways to inspire by evoking strong emotions. Let's say you work at a hotel and you want your colleagues to focus more on customer service. Go to Yelp.com, find negative comments left by customers. The reception staff was rude, gave us the wrong key, and the concierge never returned our phone calls. Print them out and circulate them. That should spark emotions. Guilt, disgust, anger, frustration, and compel people to improve. Forceful champions also circumvented resistance by deploying smart grit, which means persevering in the face of difficulty, grit, and deploying tailored tactics to circumvent opposition. Smart. Lorenzo Pacetti used smart grit to combat the attack that the powerful Consorzio del Prosciutto di Parma lobbed at her company, Volpi Foods. She took time to understand the Consorzio's concerns and then used that insight to devise a clever strategy to convince her opponents to rescind their advance. To apply smart grit, identify a colleague whose support you need and who does not support your agenda. On a piece of paper, write down your best guess at what her agenda might be. Try to understand the issues from her point of view, cognitive empathy. Then craft one or two influencing tactics to overcome her resistance. Small steps such as these help you champion your agenda more forcefully. The other way to work better with others is to revamp all those lame meetings. Whether you're participating in or running the meeting, take small steps to fight and unite better. Chapter 7. Remember the lessons we drew from Reckitt Benckiser, a manufacturer of dishwasher soap that is one of the world's top-performing companies. When teams have a good fight in their meetings, people debate, consider alternatives, challenge one another, and listen to minority views. In teams that unite, people commit to the decision taken, even if they disagree, and work hard to implement it. You can take those small steps in your next meeting. Make a better effort to listen. Put away that smartphone. Articulate your own dissenting views. Invite a colleague to argue an opposite position. Prompt quiet colleagues to speak up and pose a good question instead of telling others what you think. Then forge unity. Tell yourself to support a decision even if you disagree and ask a colleague to do the same. As you get better at this, you will find that meetings become more productive. And the good news is that once you're on that path, you need fewer meetings. You can also take small, incremental steps to discipline how you collaborate with people across organizational boundaries. Chapter 8. The doctors, nurses, and administrators at Fort Dodge Hospital changed how they collaborated across the emergency room, outpatient clinics, and in-hospital departments to better coordinate patient care without overdoing their collaboration. The results were impressive. They reduced healthcare costs and improved quality of care. In the coming week, challenge yourself to say no to 3 unnecessary collaborations. Eliminate interactions that seem least likely to add value. That phone meeting late at night where you're just listening in anyway. You're not being a bad team player by saying no. You're just optimizing your time. Once you do decide to collaborate, do it better. For every collaboration, take a few minutes to examine the unifying goal. Is there one? If so, write it down and share it with others to keep everyone focused. If there isn't, then spend a bit of time in your next meeting clarifying what it might be. You can start small on each of the 7 practices that make up the Work Smart framework in this book. Pick just a few small steps and start practicing. If you're a young professional looking to move up in your company, apply the learning loop to improve just one skill at a time, say prioritizing and becoming better at saying no. Over time, you'll find that you're working fewer hours because you're working on the right things in the right way. That frees up time you can spend outside of work, giving you a better work-life balance, less chance of burnout, and higher job satisfaction, as we discussed in Chapter 9. Our discussion of small steps returns us to a major theme in this book: the potential we all have to become not just good at work, but great. Experts have attributed top performance to factors like talent, effort, or luck. Although these play some role, my research has statistically linked superior performance to daily practice of the 7 principles. That means that anybody can become a top performer. You don't have to work crazy hours, be a genius, or be unusually lucky. You can become much better over time at working smart. Get started with small steps and keep at it, and someday you can win that gold medal in your line of work. And have a great life, too.
Great at Work: How Top Performers Do Less, Work Better, and Achieve More was written by Morton T. Hansen and read by Robert Petkoff. It was recorded by Tyler Whitlatch and Catherine Cook at CDM Sound Studio. Editing by Christina Picciano and post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Jennifer Lopes. Great at Work: How Top Performers Do Less, Work Better, and Achieve More was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Great at Work: How Top Performers Do Less, Work Better, and Achieve More is available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.